jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little low, by golly. Then we'll put them in the follies. By jingo, said by gosh, by gee. By Jiminy, please don't bother me. So they all went away singing, oh, by gee.
Hello and welcome to the American Writers 100 Pages at a Time podcast. And so in this episode, I'm going to be looking at book two of The Outsider by Richard Wright. I'm sorry, but this is a little bit delayed. Work has been catching up with me, but I think that's going to be over. So I think in the next week or two, I'll be able to finish up The Outsider and we can move on to James Baldwin and see how long that takes. That'll be a while, at least 3 months, looking at the works of James Baldwin. So, but before we can get there, we got to finish up with Richard Wright, and that means finishing up The Outsider. So, in book one of The Outsider, called Dread, we met Cross and his kind of miserable life. Damon Cross was his name, right? And he had an unfulfilled life where he had a wife he couldn't really stand. He had a job he didn't like as a postal clerk, same kind of guy as in law today, as we talked about in the last episode. He has some kids that he doesn't really have much of a relationship with. He spends a lot of time on the streets. He knocks up an underage girl and he's afraid of being arrested for statutory rape. His life is kind of falling apart around him. And it very much, even though this is kind of a sequel to Native Son, at least thematically, it's trying to be a sequel to Native Son, you feel that a lot of Law Today is in this book. And of course, that wasn't published. So he was taking stuff and ideas that were not yet published. And of course, and some of that stuff is drawing from his own life and his own experiences, right? Especially the working in a post office as a clerk. So anyways, as we know, as section one or book one ends, after we've learned how miserable this guy's life is, he gets into a car accident, it's a subway accident, right, or a train accident in Chicago. And he is declared dead because he left his jacket there and the man next to him was mangled beyond recognition. So he is presumed dead. He then takes the money in his pocket. He just borrowed a bunch of money as advances on his salary from the union, post office union or something. And then he takes that, it's like $800, quite a lot of money in those days. And he goes to check into a hotel, and it's in like a red light district. And he runs into another postal worker who recognizes him. And so like, hey, you're not dead. What's up with that? And then Damon Cross kills him. The section, book one, ends with him getting on a train to go to New York. So that gives us to book two, which is called The Dream, just Dream. And this is, my guess is, I haven't read the last three parts, Descent, Despair, and Decision, none of which sound very optimistic. This is the most optimistic part of the book, where Wright is presenting perhaps opportunities or a more hopeful picture of where his life can go. Now, as I talked about last time, I think the issue we're going to run into is obviously Wright is experimenting with existentialism, the idea that kind of we're free. Yes, we have our situation. Existence precedes essence, right? That's existentialism. But we have freedom within that, right? We have freedom, what we make of it. We can be free in prison, if we, liberate ourselves mentally and not like we're all prisoners in some way, right? So if you're a prisoner in a one-room building, a small room, or a prisoner in your job or wherever, it's still up to you to live your life that way, right? And create your own essence. In our terms of our essence, we're free, right? That's my basic memory of existentialism. And of course, he's being influenced most heavily by the French existentialists of the 1940s and 50s, like Sartre and Camus and those people. The stranger, of course, clearly being called out here. He uses the word the outsider, but the stranger, very similar kind of concept. Anyways, book two is the most optimistic because he's able to sort of remake himself. Now, I know from the Wikipedia, he kills four people by the end of this novel. So I presume that happens later in the book. And in fact, this book two ends with, finally, towards dawn, he turned over on his side and slept like a rock for the first time in many weeks. And right before that, Cross felt that he was at last awakening. The dream in which he had lived since he had fled Chicago was leaving him. The reality about him was beginning to vibrate. He was slowly becoming himself again, but it was a different self. End quote. So it's quite optimistic. He's for a while in this dream where he's can be anything, right? But he's making something new out of that, and it's taking form by the end of book two. And the question we have to ask is, Richard Wright, as an African American, looking at existentialism, to what degree is he saying, like, can black people, like, transcend their color? You know, it seems they can't. That's the point of, like, some of his other work, is that society is creating these barriers. But if you're an existentialist, you say, okay, yes, but so does everyone is kind of imprisoned in some way. So it's still a matter of making your own identity for yourself, and not just being what was defined by others. So that's the struggle. And by being dead, he's got a little bit more freedom to do that, right? There are some moments here where there's actually a discussion pretty directly about existentialism. This might be annoying to some readers because it is kind of putting his ideas right in front of him, or right in front of the readers through conversations. He's talking to this guy, Houston, who's another black man, but he's got this like hump. He's like a hunchback. And basically, Houston is talking to him about freedom and what other people make of you and what it is like to be an outsider, right? So that's another theme of this, is there's a lot of outsiders. Cross is an outsider. He runs into outsiders, and he gets involved by the end of book two with the communists, who are also outsiders. They're political outsiders in America. So anyways, Houston, this guy he meets early in book two, says, "This hump on my back ought to give me some license. I know what it means to be an object outside of the normal lives of men. I know how it feels to be stared at, to have some silly woman want to touch your hump for luck. When I was a child, I hated myself, cursed my ill fortune. But now I do not want to give up what my peculiar situation has taught me about life. This damned hump has given me more psychological knowledge than all the books I read in the university. My deformity made me free. It put me outside. It made me feel as an outsider. It wasn't pleasant, hell no. At first I felt inferior, but now I had to struggle with myself to keep from feeling superior to the people I met." End quote. So the point here being that being an outsider entails certain freedoms. And that's what Cross could not be in Chicago. He was very much an insider. He had a job, he had a wife, he had kids. He was a known entity. Only by dying, you know, in a sense, could he become an outsider and therefore free, right? So he's going to be attracted to other outsiders. And he starts to build up like a community of outsiders almost throughout book two, which also gives us a feeling of optimism here. He meets a woman who is a bit of an outsider herself and starts developing a relationship with her. He's staying at like this halfway house with like the weekly rentals and meeting people there. He ends up meeting the communists. So he's interacting with outsiders, and that's giving him sort of a community, a space to be, and he's sort of respected. Now he's taking the name Edison Jordan in this section of the book. He's going to change it a little bit later on. Now, I guess I'll get back to Cross a little bit, but I want to return to Houston briefly, because there's a long conversation here. It's about like 7-8 pages where we just kind of get Houston's philosophy, which is very much, I think, Richard Wright's philosophy at this point. And I remember he's living in Europe at this time. He's a bit of an outsider in Europe, right? So this is something that Bigger Thomas never got to feel. He never got to really be an outsider, except maybe I don't think he was thinking in these terms, but now that we've read this, we can say, well, maybe Bigger Thomas became the outsider when he was arrested, when he became the subject of media scorn. He became like the descriptions of him in the media as with the simian features. The hatred that everyone feels towards him made him an outsider, but it also, you know, was the moment when he could kind of be himself and reflect on his life honestly and not be burdened by like the outside world as much. It's like the when he meets his own Bigger Thomas. I mean, when he meets his family members in jail, it's like an awkward moment where has to fall back on like old patterns and old relationships. He's freest when he's just with his lawyer, right? At least that's how I kind of saw that. Anyways, Houston says this. Cross asks about people who break the laws of civilization. What do you feel about that? He kind of says, isn't there an obligation to society? Right? He says, the Negro feels exactly what you are asking about, but he hides it. The American Negro, because of his social and economic situation, is a congenital coward. He's scared to reveal what he feels. He feels reprisal from white neighbors. And then he says, well, they should be able to do without fear. And Cross, so they start talking about law and should you follow the rules of society, I guess. And Houston says this. He says, in a way, yes, but it all depends upon how the laws are broken. My great sympathy is to those who feel they have a right to break the law. But do you know that there are not many criminals who feel that? Most of them almost beg you to punish them. They may be lost without the law. The law's vengeance is what gives meaning to their lives, end quote. So that's sort of the bad criminal, which I don't know. I mean, obviously, Bigger Thomas, I keep going back to him, but Bigger Thomas did feel like some relish in murdering Mary, right? That was a moment in which he felt like free and he felt some agency, right? If you break the law knowing you're going to be punished, it's not real agency. He's talking about the person who's like consciously rejecting the laws of civilization. It's kind of an Ubermensch kind of figure that's being described here. A Nietzschean figure. And now he directly calls out Cross's view of civilization anyway, saying, you call this civilization? I don't. This is a jungle. We pretend to have law and order, but we don't really. We have imposed the visible order, but hidden under that veneer of order, the jungle still seethes. So it's a very fascinating conversation early on in this section. Now he finally makes it to New York City. And he walks around, I think it's 7th Avenue, and he's looking for rent signs, finding a place to rent. And eventually he does. And he rents a room for like $1 a day or something, or $10 a week it is. And he just takes the first room he gets. He doesn't care. She even asks, like, don't you want to check it out? And he's like, I don't care. As long as it has a room, as long as there's a window, you know, that's fine. And he paid a week in advance. So he's staying in this kind of place for essentially like I don't know. Do they even have these anymore? I'm sure you can get them. I guess these extended rentals, cheaper than hotels, but I suppose a little bit more marked up than like renting a real apartment. Yeah, he obviously can afford it. But he's staying in this place, and he starts to meet other people, and he has this identity of George Jordan. Yeah. He meets this woman, Hattie, who he starts to have he starts to flirt with and to try to pursue a sexual relationship with her. He's kind of rebuilding himself. And I think it's kind of fascinating to watch that happen. And it kind of encourages him to increasingly reject his former life. And he doesn't feel external pressure. That's told us, we're told that explicitly in the text. He doesn't feel the burden of society anymore. He feels only responsible for himself, right? Quote, what little external pressure had compelled him to this stance was also the part of that self which he had rejected, for he alone had been responsible for what he had done to Gladys and Dot. His consciousness of the color of his skin had played no role in it. Militating against racial consciousness in him was the general circumstances of his upbringing, which had somewhat shielded him from the more barbaric forms of white racism. Now, there seems to be some hint of obligation and you know, some guilt, maybe you want to say, about how he treated his wife and this woman he knocked up. But he doesn't have an identity anymore, so he can kind of separate himself from that. He can project it outside him. And this gives him a lot of hope for the future. You know, he can, his past is just drudgery, dullness, you know, responsibility. And he fulfilled those responsibilities fairly well. I mean, how he would have dealt with the Dot situation is not clear. He dies before that. He has to deal with that. But he's freed of all that, right? So it's kind of how people must feel if their partner dies after like a long illness and they have to take care of them all the time. Like on the one hand, you miss them and you might feel guilt over that, and you know, survivor's guilt or whatever. And obviously you fulfilled that responsibility because it was yours. And most people, I think, do fulfill their responsibilities. But that doesn't mean they like it, and doesn't mean they feel freedom from that. Freedom comes from being, like, not having those responsibilities, right? So it's not that Cross is not capable of responsibility. It's just that he can't find freedom within those responsibilities that he had. We also get his feelings about the ideologies of the time. I think this is something that Richard Wright can't escape, really, because he's always thinking about fascism and communism. We saw that in Native Son 2, where we have the communists kind of helping Bigger Thomas and trying to recruit him. At the same time, we have Bigger Thomas flirting with fascism and this kind of authoritarian impulse that comes through his character. I think this, again, this is just like Richard Wright's view on communism at this point in his life, where he thinks it's right, Marxism is correct, you can't understand industrial capitalism without it, it's fine. Stalin, he's like, I can't really judge Stalin. Let's just read this directly. Toward the ideology of communism, his attitude was ambivalent. He found as much in it to hate as to admire. He knew the imperialistic wars of the Western world far too well to be snared into believing that Stalin was the historical essence of the satanic. Even if Stalin had personally eaten 5 million human beings, it did not cancel the destruction of entire civilizations and the barbarous slaughter of countless millions by the arms of the Western world during the past 400 years. And I want to stop there. You know, we have a two wrongs don't make a right kind of argument here. But still, he's got a point. Like, can you criticize Stalin's massacres and famines and not criticize that the British are doing the same thing in India and in Africa, right? It's pretty clear now that the famines created by imperialism were greater in terms of the human toll than the famines caused by communism. There were two major famines in the socialist world, Mao's in the late 1950s and Stalin's in the 1930s. But those are at least comparable, if not superseded, by the famines that the British caused just in India, not to mention Africa, and not to mention the genocide of the Native Americans or any of these other things. So it's kind of like, we're not one to talk, but also it doesn't make what Stalin did right. You know, I think that's where Richard Wright is on this. He still thinks the imperialist world is evil, but that doesn't make Stalin good. It just kind of means you can't really criticize him without hypocrisy. All right. Further, he was constrained by logic to accept Marxism as the intellectual instrument whose absence from the human mind would reduce the picture of the process of modern industrial society to a meaningless heap. He was also compelled by facts to accept the communist notion that one form of social consciousness designated as bourgeois had been outlived. But he emphatically spurred the slavish class consciousness to which the communists sought to replace it. End quote. So he's sort of, this is where Richard Wright is, I think. He's sort of done with the authoritarian nature of the communist movement and its rigidity and its blinkered nature. But that doesn't mean he like thinks the other side of the coin has anything to offer, right? It's not just there, he's looking for something else, and I guess he never really finds it. But fascism is the other alternative out there, right? At this time, this was written early 1950s, right? 53. So fascism had been defeated. This is set, though, a little bit earlier, right? In his weighing of ideas, fascism posed the same vitally negative merit of communism in the sense of an imminent end of a system of economic domination of the Western world. But what revulsed him was in the fascist doctrine was its boast that it needed no ideological justification for its desire to rule. Life was denuded of all its meaning. When a Hitler could kill millions of men by an efficiently scientific method of mass industrial extermination simply because he did not like the color of their skins or the shape of their nostrils, end quote. So he rejects fascism really quickly, something he did not do in Native Son, I should point out. Native Son, Bigger Thomas flirts with fascism much more. This is written after World War II, after the Nazi war crimes are exposed, and I think Richard Wright added this kind of as a response to that, saying it's a, yes, it's a rejection of the West, but at least communism has like an interpretation of capitalism and a true alternative, not just murder, right? This might be him correcting for his earlier, like a little bit too open-mindedness about fascism in his earlier section. So I'm kind of running, there's not much more to say in terms of themes here because much of the rest of Book Two, Dream, involves him stealing the identity of a man who died, a black man who died in New York. So he goes over to New Jersey, where he's from, I think it's Newark, and collects his papers, collects his documents, you know, gets his ID and birth certificate and all these things, basically about posing as him. He was banking on the fact that the records would take a few days to get there. So like when he heard this guy died, he immediately goes to Newark, tracks down the records, claims to be, I forgot the name there. I knew it was LL. It's Lionel Lane is the name. He basically takes this on. I mean, there's the issue with the draft card and, you know, that he has to worry about. But, this kind of gives him a new identity that he can embrace. The paperwork he wants. Yes, like, eventually it'll be known that Lionel Lane will die, but he can still, like, carry around this identity. You know, most people won't know he's dead, right? Like, it's, you know, it's like the dead voting in Trump's fantasy of a stolen election, right? Anyways, the last part is kind of him mixing up with this guy, Gil, and who's trying to recruit him into the Communist Party. And the section basically ends with him sort of on board with this. So it's kind of reminds us of Richard Wright's own experiences as described in Black Boy, especially the American Hunger part, the second half of it, where he's brought in by this. Now, it's suggested pretty strongly here that Damon Cross, Lionel Lane now, had some like background with communism back in Chicago. Like there's a line that he got his history of the Bolshevik Revolution from Russian writers. And it seems he must have been reading that before, earlier in his life, when he was back in Chicago. So he's not entirely a neophyte to communism. But anyways, now I want to talk about one thing about the way it's written. Like, Richard Wright is constantly using these lines like, my name is Lionel Lane, Damon Cross lied, you know, like, or lied Damon Cross, or lied Cross. Which, I'm a little dissatisfied with that, because constantly being reminded that this guy is Cross seems to take away from this theme of him remaking himself with a new identity. And I kind of wish the structure of the text emphasized much more his ability to remake himself and who he is. And we don't. We're constantly being reminded as readers that this is not Lionel Lane. He's a poser. He's really just Damon Cross with a new suit on or whatever, which I don't really like. I prefer this idea of him being something new, the freedom that comes with his death and the lack of responsibility would allow him to remake himself like completely, right? But it's Richard Wright's not there yet, I guess. Or maybe we get there later in the novel. But we've already seen evidence that he is liberated. He kills someone. He never would have done that before. He abandons his wife. He never would have done that before. He joins the communists, or he gets hooked up with the communists. He never would have done that before. All these things he does are things that would have been unthinkable in his old life. His only act of freedom was essentially statutory rape of Dot. That's the only sign we get of him doing anything kind of willfully. And even that, it's not even clear how much freedom he had in that. Everything is, his life is laid out for him in every way, very much like in Law Today, where it's like a tragic story, but, and he does kind of screw himself throughout the course of the story. You want to read that and say maybe he could have gone a different way, but everything is kind of laid out by the society. But as soon as he's dead, he can be someone new. And I don't see why the text has to constantly refer to him as Cross. Can't he be someone new? Can he have this new identity? Or maybe that's something that's going to grow in him over time. And I guess we'll see. So now, the next episode, I'm going to do book three, Descent. But that's only, it's not 100 pages. The first two books were about 100 pages each. This one, book three, Descent, is only 40. So I'll read it, and then I'll do a little bit into book four, Despair, just to balance out the reading quotient. But essentially, I'll be focusing on book three. You know, it's a 500-page book in five parts, but I'll, you know, I still want to make sure I have enough to talk about in the next episode. So I'm guessing it's going to be short and impactful, so maybe it won't be a problem. But at the very least, we'll talk about all of book three, Descent, and probably a little bit of setting up at least Despair. So I'm hoping to, in the next week or so, to get this Richard Wright series done and to catch up with some of my podcasting and catch up with the Heinlein series I'm doing alongside this as well. So please listen to that if you're interested in science fiction. But that's going to be it for now. So anyways, thanks for listening to this. Let me know what you think of The Outsider and how it compares to Richard Wright's other books. And I'll see you next time when I work my way deeper into this text.
And every night they sang in the pale moonlight. Oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jaw. Oh, by jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little, oh, by golly. Then we'll put them in the fire.